Good evening, and thank you, Congressman. First of all, I love this turnout. And let me just tell you that I admire the fact that you're here, and I respect the fact that you're here. Obviously, you care enough to take time out to educate and express your opinion. Good for you. Give yourselves a round of applause. Now, we all know that some town halls have been a little contentious, let's say. And I know, you look like nice people. Don't they look like nice people? Yeah, they do. And much smarter. But just in case there's some troublemakers, Coach Craigthorpe and the boys wanted me to give you that. Just in case.
And I have one for you here from the state champion, Central High School Yellow Jackets.
There you go. We'll run a little scrimmage later on. Okay, rules are simple, and you know what they're going to be. No heckling, and maybe no booing. Come on. No heckling, no disrupting. If you are talking over somebody who's asking a question or you are being disruptive, we'll have to ask you to leave because we need to get to as many questions as possible because you want answers and you want your voices heard, right? Yeah. Congressman?
Thank you again. Thanks, Francine. Thanks again for everybody here. I'm very grateful for you, your attendance here, and your interest, your engagement. It's really important. I'm here to listen to your concerns, to hear about what you are facing and in your healthcare lives and which direction you would like to go in this country with our healthcare system. So rather than doing a long opening statement, if I actually tried to review the bill today, it would take up the entire hour and a half. So we're not going to do that. We'll try and get as much information through the question and answer period. But I'd like to ask you a few questions and then get right to yours. First, almost every day in Louisville, someone comes to me and has for the last 3 years and talks to me about the cost or access of their health insurance. How many of you have not experienced an increase in your health insurance premiums in the last 3 years? Some of you haven't. Good for you. Vast majority did not raise their hands. I think it's a major problem, and unfortunately, it's only going to get worse. Premiums are expected to increase at a rate of $1,800 per year for a family policy over the next 10 years. That means in 2020, and a family insurance policy will cost $30,000 or more. I think we would all agree that's probably unsustainable for most American families and for American businesses who are trying to help their employees acquire insurance. We have 14,000 Americans losing their coverage every day, and 62% of American bankruptcies are attributable to health care costs. And of that 62%, 80% of the people who declare bankruptcy already have health insurance. It's just inadequate to meet the unfortunate situation that they found themselves in. So I believe reform is urgently needed, but again, I want to hear what you think. So how many people here think we should do something without getting into any of the different plans or options available to us? How many people in the room think we need to do something to reform our healthcare system? At least we have a pretty good consensus right there. Now, as far as I can see it, we have four general alternatives, and maybe some of you have other ideas, and I'd love to hear them, so, and we will get into that. One is, and I'll just ask you as we go along, I'll run through them first. That's a fair way to do it. We can do nothing, see what happens. We can adopt a single-payer system that is similar to Medicare for all. All right. We can create, maybe we are voting as we go along. We can create a hybrid system that uses a public and private forces to provide a choice and competition. Okay. Or we can leave it up to the insurance companies to implement reform. Okay. All right, well, it's pretty industry action. As you probably know by now, the House bill is a public-private plan that includes insurance reforms. I'd like to get just a quick reaction to these items, and then we'll proceed with the questions. Raise your hand, please. You can scream, but I'm only going to look at the hands. If you think we should ban insurance companies from dropping your coverage when you get sick. All right. Pretty good support for that. Do you think insurance should be portable so that you don't lose coverage if you change your job or lose your job? Very good. Do you think we should end discrimination against those who have pre-existing conditions? Pretty good unanimity there. And should we limit the out-of-pocket expenses for anybody in a particular year and put a cap on and eliminate lifetime limits so if you get a cancer diagnosis, you don't go bankrupt? Good. Well, we've got a good place to start with getting some kind of consensus. So anyway, thank you for that. And with that, I'll defer to Francine to begin to ask questions.
Okay, here's how this is going to work. You all, and remember, because you're here tonight, you are part of history. So be patting yourselves and your friends on the back. All right, you filled out questionnaires. You filled out these cards. There are people with microphones that are around in different places of the auditorium. I will call your name and where you're from if you provided that. Stand so the mic people can get to you, and then you'll get to ask your question. Please don't preach or pontificate, because again, we want to get to as many questions as possible. Now, the congressman's just got one more thing to say, but I'd like to get two people on deck here. Ken Stammerman from the Highlands. Ken, if you can stand, please. Ken, all right. And Michael Maltzby from near Westport Road. Michael? Okay, all right.
Okay, the only thing I want to say now is that we are very grateful that a number of media outlets are streaming this meeting live right now, the Courier Journal and WLKY. And Metro TV is here as well, so they will be broadcasting this later, and of course you will see it ad nauseum over the next few weeks. So just realize, as I do wherever I go now, that you will be on camera.
YouTube,
and so forth. It won't just be me. It'll be you as well. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. Ken Stammerman from the Highlands has a question that concerns Democrats and Republicans. Ken.
Thank you. Thank you, Francine, and thank you, John, for being here. Okay. Hello? Okay, now here we are. Last November, the American people voted for change, and one thing we wanted was health care reform. Now, it seems to me that the Democrats have been very patient in working with the Republicans, but it's also clear to me that the Republicans don't want health care reform.
Please hear the question.
Okay, the Republicans don't want health care reform. When are the Democrats in Congress and the White House going to learn that the Republicans don't want reform and simply use our numbers, pass the bill?
Well, the last thing I want to do is...
Ladies and gentlemen, do you want to hear the answer or not? Please. Thank you.
Ken, thanks for your question. Last thing I want to do is to turn this into a partisan conflict, because, again, this is really about America's health care, and I don't want to do that. I will say that from my personal perspective, I'm not concerned as to whether Republicans are satisfied with what is done in the House. I'm only concerned with what my constituents in the country are satisfied with. So.
All right, I'll need Robert Ferry from Auburndale next. Robert Ferry? All right, and Michael Maltzby, a question about constitutionality.
Since the 10th Amendment, I have to read this too.
Project.
The 10th Amendment to the Constitution makes it clear that without constitutional authority to do so, you cannot coerce myself or my neighbors into participating or paying for health reform legislation. Please explain to us why we should not withdraw our consent to be governed by you and anybody else in government that cannot follow the rules they swore to uphold.
The extension of that argument would be that we would have no authority, or any prior Congress would have had no authority to create a public education system, to create an interstate commerce system, or in fact, ask anyone to pay to finance our defense activities. So. The Constitution says in the preamble that we the people create the government to provide for the general welfare, and that's the authority that we operate under.
I need Aaron Moriarty from Prospect on deck, please, and a question from Robert Ferry from Auburndale.
Congressman Yarmouth, thank you for taking my question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking for you.
Yeah, I'm hiding up here. Okay, I know that you're very passionate about healthcare in the United States, and I think that's great. I think that we're going about it the wrong way. I think that we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Please. You know, I see government takeover of GM. I see government takeover of Chrysler, part of the banking industry. Cap and trade, card check, all these things that are coming down the pike. My question to you is, why has the Democratic Party declared an all-out war on the American people, our Constitution, and our freedoms?
Thank you. Congressman?
Acknowledging the rhetorical nature of the question, I'm not sure there was actually a question there, but there's certainly a point made. There was certainly a point made, and I will explain, only respond in one way. The American people, during the last two congressional elections, said they want a different perspective on government. They wanted the government to take a role in trying to make this country a better place. And they elected Barack Obama because they wanted a departure. And under the prior administration and a Republican Congress, when the Republican Congress passed the prescription drug legislation, which was $850 billion unpaid for, there was no pay for in that bill. Were you there? Were you just as outspoken then about the policy?
All right, I need Christopher Ryan Cecil from the Highlands on deck, and a question from Aaron Moriarty from Prospect on tort reform. Aaron,
way back in the corner.
Nobody puts Aaron in a corner. It's kind of like The Price is Right when you're all the way up there.
Okay. I was wondering, given that the added cost to medicine due to the practice of defensive medicine and the extremely high cost of malpractice for doctors, why is tort reform excluded from health reform?
Thank you for the question. Actually, the House bill now has a provision adopted by the Energy and Commerce Committee, which does address tort reform. It creates an incentive for states through a grant program to create screening panels to screen out, weed out frivolous lawsuits like Indiana has, Texas has, California has. So that's now in the bill. I think it'll be part of the final product. So we are addressing tort reform in that way.
Follow-up question, Congressman. Will you explain what Indiana does regarding tort reform?
So was George Bush. No, he wasn't. I'm sorry. No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't. I'm sorry. He went to Harvard Business School. I misspoke. He went to Harvard Business School. Went to the same school, just the wrong
discipline. Do I have to come over there?
Yeah, probably. In Indiana, there is a panel of mostly medical professionals. When a lawsuit is proposed, it has to go to the screening panel. So the screening panel looks at it by professionally trained medical practitioners, and they basically say there seems to be, it's kind of like probable cause to believe there was malpractice, or the doctor in this particular case or the hospital followed acceptable procedures, and therefore the lawsuit shouldn't proceed. Several of the states have done that, and tort reform, by the way, historically has been a state-by-state jurisdictional matter, and that's why different states have different programs. In Kentucky, we don't have anything, but in many states, there is some combination, but what has proven to be fairly effective in holding down frivolous lawsuits and therefore malpractice premiums has been these screening panels, so we try to incentivize those in this legislation.
All right, I need Nan Milliman from Eastern on deck, and a question from Christopher Ryan Cecil from the Highlands. Christopher?
Yes, sir.
Because it's his question.
I'd like to know if you would support a bill that provides funding for abortion.
This bill now, after amendment process in committee, provides no taxpayer funds for abortion benefits.
All right, I need Nathan Prather from Hikes Point on deck and Nan Milliman's question.
If the Obama health care...
Nan, baby, shout. Gotta hear you.
Come on, Nan, you can do
better. In the cheap seats.
If the Obama health care goes through, would you be willing to forgo all of your health care, private, personal, anything that you have connected with Congress or personal, even though the rest of the Congress doesn't do that and keeps their health care?
Yeah. Let me make one clarification. The president has not necessarily proposed a public option yet. He announced today, by the way. No, wait a minute. Actually, the White House announced today he said he would prefer one. But he's going to address the nation next week in a joint session of Congress to let us know exactly what he stands for. But I'm not going to dodge your question. That issue came up in our committee, a proposal to require... The proposal came up to require members of Congress, if there is a public option, to receive their health care through the public option. And I said that I voted for it, and I do believe that we should do that, make that commitment. So, yes.
I need Deborah Sledge from Hurstbourne on deck and Nathan Prather from Hikes Point with a question.
Thanks. I'm Nathan. My question was, what role do you think racism plays in the fear of the public option, acceptance of the public option? That's it.
None.
On deck,
that's the shortest answer I've ever given to a question, by the way. want you to know.
We should give that guy a quarter. All right, Dorrance Kelly, sorry about that. I need you on deck, and Deborah Sledge with your question, please, ma'am.
From what I had heard, part of the bill was that all part-time employees, that employers would be required to carry health care on a part-time employee. And if that's true, I wondered if you've considered the fact that instead of giving us health care, what they would actually do is fire us. So is that part of the bill, that all part-time people would get health care? Because if so, I think that a lot of people like me, mothers who were lucky enough to have part-time jobs, would no longer have those part-time jobs, along with many teenagers and senior citizens that enjoy part-time work.
Right. Thank you. The way the House bill works, employers that have more than $500,000 a year in annual payroll, there's a threshold, so all small businesses at under $500,000 a year in payroll are exempted from the requirement, but employers above that are required to either provide a certain level of health care for their employees or to contribute to a fund which would then help subsidize those whether they're part-time people, uninsured, or whatever, to buy insurance in the insurance exchange. So the employer would be required to contribute if the employer did not provide benefits. Again, but that's over $500,000 in annual payroll. The whole idea is that there is shared responsibility between every American citizen and every employer to do that. One of the things that you have to keep in mind about this plan, and it is pretty complex, I concede, and that's one of the problems we have, is that one of the benefits for small businesses and for part-time employees is because too many part-time employees and employees of small businesses don't have access to any insurance. This would not only provide them access to the lowest possible cost insurance, but increase their choices, their options, to four or five options in every place in the country, so that a part-time employee wouldn't necessarily have to be left in the cold, as too many of them are right now. 60% of the uninsured people in the country are small business people, owners, or their employees. So this whole idea is to provide for those people, for part-time employees, who don't have access to any insurance because their employers don't want to insure them or can't insure them. It provides access for anybody, again, regardless of whether they have a pre-existing condition or whether they're, whatever their health history is, and so forth.
How concerned are you about employers firing people or condensing their staffs because of the additional cost?
As I mentioned earlier, 14,000 people are losing their insurance every day in this country right now. So I'm more concerned about what's going on right now than I would be under a system in which those people who lose their insurance have access to some and at low cost, and that's what we're trying to achieve.
I need James Coyle on deck. James Coyle and Dorrance Kelly's question, please.
You stated in your previous position, as well as the president, that illegal immigrants are not covered under the bill. And there is specific language in the bill that prevents illegal aliens from being covered.
Right.
However, the Congressional Research Service, your own research service, over the weekend came out and said that they are covered. And one of the reasons is because you all, along party lines, eliminated the teeth to enforce that in the Heller Amendment. How do you respond to that?
Well, first let me show for anybody who has any doubt about it, Francine did, I showed her last week. This is the section of the bill. Let me put the mic down.
No, I actually did make him show me this.
No federal payment for undocumented aliens. And I don't know how it's more clear than that.
anybody really cares a lot about that. I want to go over that one more time. That okay with you all? Where are we? Okay. This is page 143, section 246, a subsection something or another. No federal payment for undocumented aliens. Nothing in this subtitle shall allow federal payments for affordability credits on behalf of individuals who are not lawfully present in the United States. I didn't think it was in there either. What version is this?
That's the first version. That's the original version. Original version.
All right. Okay. Moving on, Steve Myers. Wait a second. Seems like there's a rebuttal. We really can't be doing this, but I'll take this guy because I'll take this guy. I'll take this guy. What? Can I get a microphone to this gentleman right there?
Sir, you did not answer my question.
What? Oh, about the Heller Amendment. About the Heller Amendment. I'm sorry. You're right. The Heller Amendment was offered in the Ways and Means Committee. What the Heller Amendment would have done would have allowed employers to have access to Social Security records to check citizenship. That's against the law right now. You can't have private entities have access to Social Security records. The teeth in this bill is that if you are applying for assistance in this bill to get subsidy to buy your health insurance, you have to prove your income, and therefore, if you filed it, you'd have to have your tax return would be evidence. So if a person filed a tax return, then that would be the evidence. Now, the whole issue of verifying legality amongst residents is something we're working on pretty hard, trying to find the foolproof way, and it's not easy to do. But we know we need to do that. When we develop the right system, we will then apply it to this bill. But right now, the presence of a tax return is the enforcement mechanism.
I just want to thank this audience so far. I think that you guys are just kicking butt. Yeah. Compared to everybody else all over the country, we are the best town hall so far. Okay. Steve Myers on deck, James Coyle, with a question.
Okay, well, during the campaign cycle, we were made a lot of promises about how our tax dollars weren't going to go up. 95% of Americans wouldn't pay any more in taxes. We were told that the president was going to, or the, you know, eventual president Obama was going to go line by line and get rid of wasteful government spending. That hasn't happened. We have a Medicare system that is broke and has no money. We have Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, all these programs. Everyone will agree, if they're not broke now, they will be shortly. By adding another cloak of federal government bureaucracy around all of that at $1 trillion+, how in the world are we going to pay for it? And please, please, Congressman, don't tell me we're going to pay for it with savings.
Well, you ask a lot of questions in there, and I'll try to address some of them. But the main one is, the question was, how are we going to pay for all this? The answer is, I don't know. Let me explain how we're going to pay for this proposal. We've got a lot of serious problems, long-term problems that have been here for a while and developed. Let me tell you about the problem with Medicare. We face, with Medicare, a $37 trillion in additional debt over the next two generations if we don't make changes in the Medicare program. $37 trillion. Every year we wait But wait a minute, this is an answer to why we have to act even though these aren't the best times. Every year we wait to begin to change the trajectory of cost in Medicare, we add between $1 and $2 trillion to the ultimate national debt. So yes, it's tough, but here's how we're proposing to pay for this proposal. Half of the money, roughly $500 billion, is as a surcharge on the taxes of people making over $500,000 a year. That's half of it. Oh, we have that many people? We have a very rich crowd or people who are really concerned about very rich people. The second part of it, the other half of the program is paid for with some cuts in programs like Medicare Advantage. Well, it's okay if you disagree with the cuts, but I'm explaining what it is. And I know it seems counterintuitive that you say, are there $500 billion worth of cuts in Medicare and Medicaid? We will spend over those next 10 years somewhere around $10 trillion on Medicare and Medicaid. So $500 million is about 5%. If anybody doesn't think that we can find 5% of savings in those programs, I think it's pretty easy to do it. And let me just explain one more thing about Medicare. Medicare works very well for people who have the benefit. It has an insufficient finance mechanism. Right now, when it was created in 1965, there were 10 workers paying Medicare tax to support every beneficiary, and life expectancy was 67 or 68. Now it's 80. We have 3 workers supporting every beneficiary. The Medicare system does very well with the money it has. It doesn't have nearly enough money. And that's the problem with the entire healthcare system, people. We're all Americans. We want to do everything we want, eat, drink, smoke, anything we want, and then... And then when we get sick, we want the best health care in the world. We don't want to pay for it. I understand all that. But that's the problem we face. We've got a culture that we need to correct.
Can you really vote on a bill when you yourself say there's no funding mechanism and you're not sure how
to
pay for it
yet? No, I said there is a funding mechanism. This bill will not add to the deficit over 10 years.
We'll see.
I would also like to say one thing. All of these things, let's be very, very fair about this. All of these things are based on estimates which are totally unreliable. The last 3 times, I mean, we know that. CBO, look. It is virtually impossible in this country to project what the economy is going to do 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now. Remember, CBO... The CBO projected in 2000 that we were going to have a $5 trillion surplus. Now they project a $9 trillion deficit. I hope they're as wrong this time as they were the last time. But the problem is these estimates may or may not be reliable. We just have to go with the best numbers that they provide, and that's what we're trying to do. Anybody who thinks they have a better estimating or evaluating methodology, please let us know, because I'd love to have something else.
Okay. Tim Root on deck. Tim Root on deck, and Steve Myers with a question.
Thank you, Congressman. My question concerns the addition of 50 million uninsured currently. That's the estimate. And knowing that medical education requires 7 years of training beyond college, who will care for those patients beginning tomorrow when the clinic doors open?
Steve, that's a great question, and it's something that not only have we discussed at length and we try to address in the bill, but it's something there is bipartisan agreement on. There is absolutely no partisan dispute on this. We need to focus on it. One of the things, just a couple things, and it really doesn't even make any difference to the answer to your question. But under this bill, the vast majority of people come, the uninsured, who are brought into the system are brought in beginning in 2013 and later. But that doesn't at all mitigate the problem. We have a huge problem right now in healthcare personnel, particularly with regard to primary care, particularly in rural areas. We're in relatively good shape in Louisville, and most urban areas are. But we have a huge national problem, and again, particularly in the areas of primary care. So two ways that we begin to approach it, and you're right, it's a long-term approach, is we have some very major workforce development programs in here that involve tuition forgiveness, tuition subsidies for med school, for healthcare professionals, for doctors, tuition, a student loan forgiveness, so that docs don't come out of med school with $300,000 and $400,000 worth of debt, which means they then go in, they have to go into a specialty because they can't make enough money in primary care, which is where we really need the help. And Dr. Troutman's here from Louisville Metro Health, who's really on top of this issue. And we do the same thing with nursing, and we actually also try to change the way we deliver care so that nurse practitioners can get more involved in primary care areas. So to the extent that federal policy can drive that, we are trying to create the kinds of incentives that will, again, have more people choose primary care, move personnel from specialties into and nurse practitioners into primary care, because you're right, if we bring, the estimate is we'll bring maybe 37, 38 million people ultimately into the system who are not in it now. Now, all that being said, those 37 or 38 million people, when they get sick, are getting care. They're getting care. They're just going to the emergency room or to one of the community health clinics here, like Park Duval or Portland. They're going to places to get care, but it's the most expensive care because they could have headed off a lot of that more expensive care if they had primary care. So it's a great question. Thank you for it. And one more thing, Francine. And there is a considerable increase in support for community health centers in this bill because we recognize that has to be part of that solution.
All right, I need Court Clayton from Hurstbourne on deck, and Tim Root with a question.
Recently, the CEO of Whole Foods wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal outlining some free market ideas to help the healthcare system. I'm wondering if you're familiar with those, and if you and some of the congressional leaders would consider those ideas, instead of the whole government 1,000-page H.R. 3200.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. We consider virtually any idea, believe me. We're looking for the most creative ideas possible. But the idea of free market solutions is somewhat of a problem when you get to healthcare, because healthcare does not always respond to the laws of supply and demand. When you get sick, the laws of supply and demand don't apply. You can't, in most cases, you don't determine when you get sick and therefore when you need the healthcare system. So that's why free market approaches don't always work in healthcare. In one respect, we don't have a free market approach now with regard to private insurance. As I said before, the insurance industry is the only insurance industry, Major League Baseball, the only two businesses in the country that are exempt from the antitrust laws. And in virtually every state, one or two insurance companies control a majority of the business. In Kentucky, two companies have 70% of the business in Kentucky. And the reason that's important is because if an insurance company wants to come into Kentucky to compete with the two who dominate the market, they have to go out and negotiate for a provider network, make deals with doctors, make deal with hospitals and so forth. And that becomes, there's an anti-trust restraint there because of the market domination. So We'd love to use all the free market principles. One of the things that the House bill tries to do is to create competition for the insurance companies, which they now don't have.
There are a number of people who are afraid that the public option is going to put the private insurers out of business because of a government advantage.
Thank you.
Once again,
I only have one estimate to rely on, and that's the Congressional Budget Office. They projected that in 10 years, by 2019, if the public option is adopted as in the House bill, there will be 30 million people who will have been shopping for insurance in this marketplace that's created in the bill. 20 million of them will have selected private plans. 10 million of them will have selected the public option. And 180 million people will still be in private insurance. So if their projection is right, let me explain why that is. The public option is going to have to come in and set up the same provider network that any insurance company does. If your doctor, or if you like Norton Hospital or Jewish Hospital, if they're not in the public option network, you're going to choose to be in Humana's plan or Anthem's plan or WellPoint's plan. And that's why, let me put it this way. We spend in this country billions and billions of dollars every year on bottled water. And we have a pretty good public option to that. It's turn on your tap. People still buy public water. They still buy bottled water. And we also have a pretty good, we have a public education, we have public colleges, we have private colleges. People pick what they like.
I need Dan Prather from Hikes Point on deck and Court Clayton from Hurstbourne with a question. Court?
Where's Court?
Jump up and down.
Oh, up there, okay.
Oh, okay. Cheap seats again. Oh, come on, that's a joke, you know that. How much did you pay? Come on.
Okay.
Okay. But let's grab Court while we're waiting.
I'm Dan Prather, and I'm actually on deck, but I guess I'll go ahead. First of all, Mr. Yarmouth, I'd like to thank you for your service. I think you're doing a tremendous job. And I know you wanted to limit this to questions, but that was my son, Nathan, earlier. I just have to point that out. He did a great job. Anyway, what will happen if the obstructionists succeed in blocking healthcare reform? What's the next thing will happen if the next step? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dan. Thank you for the comment. I know this doesn't mean anything to some people, but it is a great honor to serve this community. But I think what some of the things that we talked about earlier are what things we have to keep in mind. We're looking at enormous hikes in the cost of pre-insurance premiums over the next 10 years. Insurance premiums over the last part of this decade, from 2000 to 2008, rose at 3 times the rate of wages. They rose somewhere between 70 and 80% over the last 7 or 8 years. We know, I already talked about what's going on in Medicare with the increased losses that we face, and we face a structural deficit in Medicare beginning in the next 5 years, which will reach $600 billion a year. That's because the baby boomers are about to enter the system and become eligible. And again, our financing system is just not adequate for that. So we've got enormous problems, and quite honestly, you hate to be a doomsayer, but we're facing an unsustainable healthcare future if we don't start making these reforms now. And we... There are certain things we can do and should do right now that we're going to get at. There's one thing that we believe could save system-wide. Now, I'm not just talking about the federal treasury, but system-wide, $30 billion a year in health care, and that's by creating a standardized billing form so that hospitals and doctors don't have to fill out 10 different forms for 10 different insurance companies or the government, and that every doctor's office has... You know, three people, eight people that do nothing but fill out those forms. There's a great deal of money spent in the country for services that really don't pay for care. The estimate is most, and it'll vary from insurance company to insurance company, but it's about 20 to somewhere between 20 and 30% of the insurance premiums go not to pay for care. They go for the operation of the insurance company and their profits. So we've got to figure out how to take some of that money and redirect it into care. And that's one of the reasons why we think competition will do that. But that's kind of the dilemma we face.
I need Deborah Schneider on deck, please. Deborah Schneider. And y'all help me here because Miss Grace Lewis has a question.
When I worked for the United States Congress Subcommittee on Labor Standards, Congressman John Conyers had introduced H.R. 676, which provides single-payer universal health care for all. I believe firmly that health care is a right, and it's not, and health. I believe that health care is a right. I believe in single payer. So what my question is to Congressman John Yarmuth, since the congressional block,
Please let her ask her question.
Since the congressional... Now, wait a minute.
Ms. Lewis, like everyone else, deserves a chance to just ask the question. So just give her a second, okay? Please.
Okay, the Congressional Budget Office has stated that with H.R. 676, and if we cut out all of the administrative costs that is associated with comprehensive health coverage, we would save $400 billion. And I think that is more than sufficient to provide for comprehensive health care. Congressman Yarmuth, should the Obama bill fail, will you support H.R. 676?
You know, I didn't quite get what H.R. 676 is. Could you help us, please?
H.R. 676, the John Conyers legislation, provides for what is called a single-payer healthcare system, which would mean essentially... Well, booing's not going to change my explanation of it. You can be against it. I understand there are people who don't support it, but I was asked to explain it, so that's what I'm trying to do. It provides a single-payer system, which would essentially mean that the government, similar to Medicare, would pay for, become the payer of all insurance premiums. Now, single-payer can mean a lot of different things. There are dozens of single-payer systems around the world that most of which, as a matter of fact, all of which except for Canada, keep a private insurance system, and that's part of the whole program. And with very few exceptions, it is what we call it would be government-paid, privately delivered healthcare, which is different than the VA, which is government-paid, government-run healthcare, because the government owns the hospitals, employs the docs and the nurses. Under most systems, it is government-paid, privately delivered, and that's what I am convinced, whether we like it or not, we will end up with at some point in this country. But, and wait a minute. But I'm going to answer the question directly because I'm a co-sponsor of 676 and we'll vote for it if it comes to the floor.
All right. Ready for another question? I got more. I've got more. Okay. Grace, why did you start, Grace? All right, I need Patricia Morgan on deck and Deborah Schneider with a question, please. Troutman, you watch Grace from now on. She's close to you.
Okay, first of all, I want to say that even though I am a Democrat who strongly opposes this bill as it is written, I firmly believe we need some health care reform, and I thank you for having the courage to have this town hall meeting. Okay. My question is, if the government option is just supposed to be another option, if we can keep the plan that we currently have, if we like it, then why does this bill prohibit private insurance companies from writing any new individual policies or making any changes to existing policies? And further, why would all existing employment-based health plans have to be changed after 5 years to meet the same requirements as a qualified health plan under this bill?
Great. Thank you. And the answer is because at the beginning of the program, I read you certain things and I asked you if you supported them. No pre-existing conditions, no limits on lifetime benefits, limit on out-of-pocket expenses. And what that provision of the bill does is to make sure that no insurance policy sold in the United States, now that doesn't mean things like Aflac or if you want to have plastic surgery insurance or if you want to have long-term care insurance, but in order to be a qualifying health care benefit plan under this bill, it has to comply with the standards. And that's why if you have an employer-based plan that has a lifetime limit of $250,000, which is one of the reasons that so many people go bankrupt in this country right now, you would not be able to use that as a qualifying plan. You would have to comply with those standards that are in the bill. That's why that provision's in there. And again, those provisions seem to have broad support here.
Michael W. Ignew from PRP. Sorry, Michael. On deck, and Patricia Morgan, please, with your question.
Hello. I wanted to find out the purpose of having this meeting. I thought that the purpose of a town hall meeting was for the constituents to let the congressmen know what we want, and it seems to me like it's already preordained how you're going to vote.
If we can let her get to the question part, though. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Was that actually the question you'd like me to respond to, or is it a question?
Okay. I'm
not sure. I wish every one of you were sitting in the meetings with me and we're going through the process and work through the legislative process. And one of the things that is so exciting about not just this meeting, but this issue, is that this is the first time the American people have been so thoroughly engaged in the legislative process. As I have said many times throughout this process, we are trying to work through a very complex situation. We're talking about 18% of the American economy. We're talking about something that personally and directly affects every American and their lives and their families, and it is not easy to do, but we know we have to make reform. This process tonight is part of that. We're gonna have we don't know coming back next week to Congress. The president's gonna make a speech. He may totally change the path of this legislation. So we don't know what we're actually going to be voting on. We don't know whether we're gonna be voting on it in September, October, or next year, or whether we're gonna be voting on it at all. One of the things that's entirely possible, is that we will carve out pieces of this legislation and pass the ones that we have broader support for, like the insurance reforms. We might do that. So that's why this input is very, very important. But let me add one thing. This is not the first time, with all due respect, this is not the first time I have heard these issues raised. It's not the first time I've heard about people's concerns about healthcare. As I've said, we've been getting input since I started campaigning for office in 2006. In my 2.5 years in Congress, we get thousands of letters, emails, phone calls every day. I've met with every conceivable interest group, met from the medical community, the insurance community, the hospital community, you name it, every citizen group, the single payer supporters, the people who are opposed to care. I meet with them all the time, and we're actually going to put a list of all the people we have gotten input from on our website so that you can see the variety of advice and guidance that we get. So again, I very, very much value the input here, but it's a part of a lot of input that I have gotten over the years.
I think people realize there's a lot of input, but I think the question is your mind already made up regardless?
I have said on numerous occasions in public that I have two standards that I'm concerned about when we do health reform. One is that nobody dies or suffers unnecessarily because they don't have access to insurance. And secondly, that nobody goes bankrupt because of an illness or an accident. Beyond that, I am agnostic about how we get there. If anybody, again, if there is a solution that is better than this, and I know you all think that this one's not right, but I haven't heard a lot of alternatives, we welcome that. And let me stress one other thing. And again, this is kind of maybe too much process-oriented and inside baseball. I'm one of 435 members. I happen to serve on one of the committees that is very much directly involved in drafting this legislation.
If I were
drafting reform by myself, I would write it a very different way. But it is a collegial process, and there's one thing. You know, the old joke is there are two things you don't want to watch being made: laws and sausage. And we're in the sausage-making process right now.
So is that a yes or a no? Is your mind made up?
No, as I said, I'm concerned about ultimate results for the American people. How we get there, we're going to do it the best way we can.
All right. Thank you. I need Gina Whitworth on deck. Gina Whitworth and Michael Igneau.
Is it halftime yet?
You know, you don't get an intermission. We're on your clock here, so. Do we have Michael? All right, Gina. Can somebody get to Gina? Thank you so much.
I am a nurse, and I'm not here as being Democrat or Republican. My question is, I have an 89-year-old patient that has colon cancer and is receiving chemotherapy. In this bill, can you guarantee me 100% that she would be allowed to continue that chemotherapy and that decision would only be made by her and her doctor? Because right now, she doesn't have any having to go through, you know, getting permission to do that. And my other question is, right now with my Anthem insurance, I get a booklet that tells what's covered, what's not, what percent. Why is this 1,080 pages or whatever long? Why do you not put out a book that all of us can read? If Anthem's capable, why can't the United States government? Hey, Gina, we need a mayor coming up pretty soon. Think about it.
Yeah, as to the latter part of your question first, I am right there with you. We have what's called legislative counsel. They do the actual drafting of these bills. They are drafted in a way that no human being can understand them. I totally see. Hey, part of it's because, you know, lawyers write laws certain ways. There are too many lawyers in Congress, we know that. But that's one of the problems with this bill. It's one of the problems with the bill. And I will say, by the way, and Francine and I have discussed this, virtually every, and it relates to the first part of your question, virtually every section of this bill amends another part of existing law. So in order to actually figure out what it means, you can't just read the bill, you have to read the legislation, it changes. And so somebody, one person has estimated you'd actually have to read 9,000 to 10,000 pages of statute before you could really understand what this bill does. The section that your question implied, I think, is Section 1233 that actually amends a section of the Social Security Act to provide that if your patient's family wants to have a discussion, not necessarily when she's sick at any time, about end-of-life decisions and end-of-life options and planning, that Medicare will pay for it. It doesn't force anybody to have that decision. It doesn't mandate anything. It just says, if you want to have that discussion with your physician, the physician can be compensated under Medicare, because right now the physician cannot be paid under Medicare for having that conversation and giving you counsel. So as to the first question, I will promise you 100% that there is nothing that would change the relationship between your patient and her doctor. And you know, my mother's 82, and believe me, I wouldn't vote for anything that would change that relationship either. And by the way, she's covered, I'm sure, under Medicare, a single payer system privately provided, which does not interfere in that relationship.
I need Angela Lewis on deck. Angela Lewis and James Matheson with his question. James Matheson. James.
Representative Yarmuth, as you contemplate spending our money on health care reform and other issues in Washington, I want to know what kind of steward you've been with your own money. When you were an owner and founder of Leo Weekly, did you think that you made health insurance affordable for your employees? And what percentage of their premiums did you pay? And now, as an owner investor of Sonny's Barbecue and Almost Family Home Health Care, do you think that you make that insurance affordable for those employees as well? And what percentage do you pay for them?
Thank Well, I don't have anything to do with the operation of Sonny's Barbecue. I am an investor, but I have no idea what, you know, that's based in Florida, and there are no employees of the company in Kentucky, so I have no idea. I don't know how it's relevant to this discussion. I will say, though, as the manager, of Leo, and I was not the business manager. That was my partner, Blanche Kitchen. I was, you know, mouthing off in editorials. We did the best we could to provide as much coverage for our insurance for our employees as we could. We faced the same problem as any other small business does, and we faced a very specific problem which would be addressed by this bill. We had 22, 23 employees, virtually all of them were young and healthy, except we had one middle-aged woman who had cancer. Because we were a small employer in small numbers, and because we had one person who was very expensive to treat, we kept getting premium increases of 20, 25% each year. We'd have to shop around, see if we could do better, change our deductibles, change our copays. And it was tragic because of the misfortune of one individual. Not just the company suffered, but the other individual employees suffered too, because they didn't get as good a coverage as they otherwise would. And that's what this bill is designed to do, to eliminate that discrimination. So that if I were in that situation again, I would be able to have the same bargaining power as any large corporation. I could get the lowest rates, and nobody in my office would be penalized because somebody had the misfortune of getting cancer.
I need Mildred Baldoff. Sorry, Mildred. Mildred Baldoff on deck, and Angela Lewis with a question, please.
Okay, my question is, this bill is not supposed to add any debt to our now projected $9 trillion budget deficit. We've been told how budget cuts and taxing the successful will keep this bill from adding any more debt. But what if it doesn't? Don't you think we need a backup plan, or as this government likes to say, an exit plan? And what would be yours? How much debt would you be allowed to be added to our deficit before it's too much?
We have an extremely large and dynamic economy, and I'm not sure if you could ever come up with a number. We are adding too much debt right now. We know that. The question is, and I understand this is very difficult to get your arms around, but the question is, when we faced the deficit last year, we were looking, when we came in, you know, we came back from the election the next week. Well, first of all, we had, back in last September, we had Secretary Paulson and Secretary Bernanke tell us that, it was actually the week of the Ryder Cup, I was on a conference call when they said, if you don't come up with $700 billion right now, the financial system is going to collapse and the lights are going to go off.
The lights already went off that week.
That's right. They did go off earlier that week.
That was the windstorm week.
That was the windstorm prior to the Ryder Cup. You're right. So ever since then, we have had this incredible financial crisis that you all are, you know, you read about every day and saw. We were facing in this economy basically a gap of 10% of demand in gross domestic product that where we had excess capacity and not enough over demand. And there was nobody left to fill that gap. Usually what we do in situations like that is use monetary policy. We drop interest rates so it stimulates purchases and so forth. We'd already done that as low as we could make it. The Fed had already reduced the rate to zero. So there was no one left to fill that gap. And if we had not acted at that point, and this is what's so hard for, you know, for anybody to fully grasp, is that it would have been far worse than it otherwise is. And we are still in that situation. Now you can, you know, as you probably can tell, I'm not an economist. But during the beginning of this year, the end of last year, virtually every economist across the political spectrum, from the most conservative to the most liberal, said the government has to fill that gap or the deficit is going to be much greater because more people are going to lose their jobs, tax revenues would be even lower, and so forth and so on. So I know it's almost counterintuitive, but most economists, again, across the spectrum, not just the most liberal economists, said the government needs right now to keep spending in order to mitigate the long-term damage. Hey, you can scream at me and believe me, but that's not me. That's actually the Bush administration and then our administration. So, anyway, I don't know that there's any way to answer that question with a specific number. I do know that most of the economists, again, these are the Council of Economic Advisors, you name them, they say right now the level of debt as a percentage of gross domestic product that we have in this country and that we will have over the, with, including that $9 trillion, if that's the number it ends up being, is manageable in its way, but it's not sustainable. So we have to take the action now, even though we may be, you know, no matter what we do right now, we're going to have substantial deficits because we are in such a deep hole. And we've got such incredibly bad unemployment and revenues down. So, and I understand people say cut spending. Let me tell you what's available to us. But I will tell you, I understand that theory, but I will tell you that virtually every economist says, again, conservative and liberal alike, that if we cut spending right now, what will happen to us is what happened in the 30s, and we will be in a full-fledged depression.
Okay. Dennis Hyde on deck, Mildred Baldoff. With a question, please. Mildred? Sorry, I can't see very well. Is Mildred here? Oh, okay.
Yes, healthcare reform seems like a no-brainer. Have the lobbyists played any part in this bill?
Well, bless you for the question. Right now, the insurance industry is spending $1.5 million a day lobbying on this bill. The drug companies, I don't know how much they're spending, but drug companies are actually supporting the bill right now. Pharma is, but they have two lobbyists in Washington for every member of Congress. There are about 1,000 pharmaceutical company lobbyists in Washington. There are lobbyists representing the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, the home health care companies, the skilled nursing facilities, the trial lawyers. It is without question the most intensely lobbied bill in the history of the United States.
Okay.
And believe me, they have spent fortunes in contributing to the campaigns of both Democrats and Republicans and they've spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars making campaign contributions, all of those interested parties, to Democrats and Republicans. And that's why I'm convinced that we need public financing of campaigns so that influence does not dominate your voices.
Congressman, what kind of pressure and contact have you gotten from lobbyists and special interests?
Well, we don't get, I mean, it's not a question of pressure. We really don't get much pressure.
Do they call you, or are they trying to get...
They come see the staff. They call, sure, they do that all the time. But the most pressure is not overt pressure. It's not, you better do this or we're going to, you know, we're going to do whatever. It is the fact that they put so much money in campaigns that there is the subtle and maybe sometimes not so subtle internal pressure to do what they want to do. Because in order to, you know, this is, I hate the system, believe me. I want to change it. I wish you all would support public financing of campaigns. I promise you. I promise you that the American people, individual average citizens, will never get a fair shake in this country, particularly on an issue like health care, until we get the big money out of the political system.
Marianne Hsu on deck, Marianne Hsu on deck, and Dennis Hyde with a question.
Hello. It's hard for me to believe that you can add 40 million non-payers to a system, deny less claims instead of more, allow for pre-existing conditions, not affect Medicare, not subsidize from private insurance, and not ration care, and at the same time save us money.
Well,
so my question is, because I do want Americans to have access to health care, my question is, why can't we pilot this program in a state or a small geographical area first? Because I feel like with 1/7 of the nation's GDP in limbo, it's at least worth the trial run first before we all have to jump on.
Yeah, that's a great question, and we do have some pilot programs in the bill to try to figure out, maybe to test some different ways of providing care so we create more cost-effective care. And you know, there's some things called accountable care organizations like the Mayo Clinic and a concept called medical homes where somebody, some medical professional, is actually coordinating the care so you don't duplicate a lot of testing and a lot of procedures and so forth. We do have some pilot programs in there. The problem with doing kind of the big reform on a pilot program basis. Well, Medicare you have to separate out because that's a nationwide program and it would be tough to pilot, although there may be some delivery system issues we could test, is that in Kentucky, for instance, we had some people in the Senate side are considering the co-op concept as an alternative to a public option. The co-op being that citizens get together and doctors and hospitals and they all pay themselves, just like the rural electric cooperatives, so the insurance system is self-contained and self-financed among a certain population. They've tried it in Seattle. It's been relatively effective in Seattle. That concept may work in Seattle, but I guarantee it won't work in Eastern Kentucky. Because there's no money in Eastern Kentucky, and there's no provider network. They have an incredible shortage of providers. So in order for them to get together and create a decent healthcare system, it's just probably not going to work. At the point being, there are places that some things might work, and there are places they definitely wouldn't work. One of the proposals that's being made, which I have absolutely no trouble with, is to allow insurance companies to sell across state lines. I have no problem with doing it. The problem with it is, the problem with it is, if that were the case, there is no insurance company anywhere in the country that would come to Kentucky to sell insurance. Because we have the sickest population in the country, the least healthy population in the country. Ask Dr. Troutman, we know that. We have the sickest population in the country, and there would be no possibility for most insurance companies to come in, start new, develop a private network, competing with those that are already tied up. What they would do is probably go to Utah, where they have the healthiest population in the country because it's the youngest, and they'd all try to get into Utah, but they wouldn't try to come in here. So again, a lot of these things, and you know, the bottom line is probably a lot of pilot projects. Again, could be very effective in some places, not in others, but we do have some pilot programs in here. And I will say, finally, you know, we may end up doing that with part of the policies in here, the programs in here. Could very well happen.
All right, the networks and all the broadcasters are on a very tight timeline, as is Central High School. Marianne, if you go with your microphone person, we'll bring you down for a one-on-one question with the congressman. That wraps up tonight, but I want to tell you something. First of all, this is one representative. There are more, and we also have two senators, so don't stop letting your voice be heard and loudly. Thank you so much for participating tonight. Thank you so much for being a fabulous audience. Please drive safely. Good night.
Good night. Thank you very much, all of you.